Let's clear out winter and clean up the lawn with Spring Black Friday savings at the Home Depot. Right now, get the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower for just $89 and make your lawn work easier with a powerful 90 miles an hour of clearing power. And with convenient online shopping, you can order on the app, pick up in store, and get outside sooner. Get your yard spring ready with the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower, now just $89 during Spring Black Friday at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products. Because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Go behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey everybody, welcome to Car Stuff. I'm Scott Benjamin, the auto editor here at HowStuffWorks.com.
My name is Ben Bolin. I do a lot of things here, but one of my favorite things to do at our job is to hang out with you, Scott.
Yeah, and talk cars, right?
And talk cars.
Talk cars. Well, thanks, Ben. That was nice.
Hey, and also sincere, but let me be honest with you. There's the reason that I'm here is to talk about cars.
I understand. I know it's the highlight of your day, right?
Hey, wait, real quick aside. Have you ever read the transcripts that we have on the website?
What do you mean? Like what part? What are you talking about?
All of our podcasts have transcripts so that people who are deaf or hard of hearing or want to figure out how to spell what we're talking about can check it out and read the transcripts. It's weird. It looks like we're sending text messages to each other.
No.
Yeah, there's a picture of your face and then, you know, like the line where you say something is a picture of my face. And yeah, I read them.
Even more pressure because – you know what's funny? I used to work in video, and I would transcribe tapes, right? And you do interviews, and you would come back and transcribe it to put it into prompter, you know, for it so you could read closed captioning.
Sure.
Invariably, it made no sense what the person was saying once you put it down on paper. But if you were listening to the person, it would make sense. Like it sounded, you know, clear, and it sounded that, you know, it was flowing. Everything worked well together. But when you typed it out and you read what the person was really saying, it was just a big mix of nothing. It was like somebody, you know, speaking around a talking point.
It was stream of consciousness, sort of improvisation.
Really right? Yeah, it just doesn't make sense. So I'm apprehensive to look at that.
Let me reassure you, I checked, and we don't sound that bad. We don't read that bad at all. We are very much legible. If anything, I think I may be the weaker member of the duo.
I don't think so. Do they also take out all the times when I go,
They took out a lot of our uhs and our ums.
Oh, good. Okay.
But, helps. So as a PSA, not to give you any pressure, Scott, but as a PSA to our listeners, if you haven't heard already, you can check out transcripts of all our podcasts if you want to read rather than hear what we're saying.
I don't know. Oh man, that would be awful. I don't know. Sorry.
It's really not that bad.
I didn't mean to undercut what you're saying there, but man, I wouldn't do it myself.
It's really not that bad. I was actually very pleasantly surprised.
Okay, good. All right. Well, let's move on to the important topic of the day.
Yes, let's go to the real thing.
I want to talk about Bruce McLaren and McLaren cars. And I think this is an interesting cat that we need to discuss because he follows along the lines of so many other people that we've talked about. We talked about Jim Hall and his Chaparral cars. We talked about Colin Chapman and, of course, the Lotus vehicles. And,
yep.
You know, the other, I guess, really, really influential, important people along the way of the development of certain automobiles. And even in this case, we're talking about a line of racing cars.
Yeah. Pioneers.
Exactly. Pioneers. And I think that, I think this guy is someone that has, I guess the legs to make this an interesting story.
Absolutely.
Definitely an interesting story and one that continues through today.
Yes, and it starts, if you would like to be technical about it, it starts in 1937 in Auckland, New Zealand, when Bruce is born a Kiwi.
That's right. Yeah, we mentioned that earlier, right?
Did, yeah.
It's a funny thing to say, but yeah, I guess that would make him a Kiwi, right?
I think so.
A New Zealander?
Uh-huh.
A Kiwi? They say that. It's just a slang term, I think. I don't know if it's a real way to refer to that person or not. Are you a Georgia Peach, Ben?
Gosh, no. I'm whatever there is in Tennessee.
I don't know. I'm a Hoosier.
Ah, yes.
I don't really know what that is.
I was hoping you would explain it to me.
No, I don't know.
Well, so, okay. So we've got.
I'm also a hoser. That's from Canada.
Is that what the Canadians?
I guess so.
Call your folk?
No.
So Bruce is born, as we said, 1937, but something some folks may not know about Bruce is that he did not begin as a car company owner. He began as a race car driver.
That's right, and a very successful race car driver.
Oh, who are you telling, right?
Along the way, yeah, he, I read something about this in his biography, and there's a pretty good biography posted online you can read, actually several of them, but in the August 1970 edition of Road and Track, they've reprinted some of that information, biography information about Bruce.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes all the way back to when he was about 16 years old and he competed in his first hill climb race. He was in an Austin 7. Does that sound familiar? Colin Chapman.
Yeah.
Remember that? His Austin 7 was really the first Lotus, you remember?
Mm-hmm.
And so he competed just like Colin did at early age in an Austin 7. So that was apparently the car to modify at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And even, I guess, he was always this really competitive, really driven individual. And his parents said that, you know, they could always see that kind of spirit in him, that he was always one to want to achieve more.
That ambition.
Yeah, he always had that ambition. And that proved to be, just kind of a big part of his entire life, really.
Absolutely. Just to tell you guys, by way of experience, how skilled Bruce McLaren was, and I guess remains, as a racer.
Mm-hmm.
1959 U.S. Grand Prix.
Mm-hmm.
He wins it at the ripe old age of 22.
Yeah, no kidding. And you know what? I've got a figure on that. I think he was actually the youngest driver to win an F1 race at the time.
Yes.
Now, I think that's been eclipsed at this point, but only by a matter of days.
Mm-hmm.
He was 22 years old, winning a Formula One race, which is just remarkable. I mean, he was a young guy, very talented, and that continued on because he won the U.S. Grand Prix that year.
Yep.
He had in his driving career, I mean, this is among others, we'll mention others too, but just in F1, he had 4 Grand Prix victories, which is pretty significant.
Mm-hmm.
1960, he won in Argentina. 1962, Monte Carlo. And then in 68, he won in the Belgian Grand Prix. Mm-hmm. But that wasn't the only series that they competed that he competed in.
He went
beyond Formula One cars. He also raced in, as we'll talk about later, the Can-Am series, very successful in that series, and the Indy 500 and the IndyCar series. So.
Yeah.
Which wasn't the IndyCar series at the time. It was just the Indy 500 race.
And he won Le Mans in 1966.
Yes. That's a huge one because you know what he was driving in 66?
He was with Ford, right?
Yeah, that's right. So that meant he was behind the wheel of a Ford GT40, which is – I think that's really cool. That was with the Shelby American team.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a 7-liter GT40 V8, of course. But he also – won the 12 Hours of Sebring with Mario Andretti in 1967. So this guy's got, you know, he gets around. He gets around, this guy.
He's doing what Charlie Sheen would call winning.
Yeah, that's
right. I'm sorry, that's so dated.
Oh, man, yeah, it is. I can't believe anyways, he's a winner in the F1 series. In a car that later we'll find out he designed and built, had other successes as well. But the Can-Am, he was successful in the Can-Am series. He won the IndyCar race outright in Indy 500 rather. Mm-hmm. And they also compete. He also competed in the European and American Formula Series. That includes Formula 2 and Formula 1 Series. Mm-hmm. So this guy, he, like I said, very, very successful racing career, which led him to want to, as Colin Chapman did, kind of develop his own thing.
Right, to branch out. So he, in, where are we at here? 65 when he decides to build his own car?
Yeah, I guess we're jumping around a bit because we talked about all these victories and everything. But if you want to go right to 65 because that sets us up for McLaren Racing Limited.
Yes.
So if you want to do that, that's great.
Okay, so he, 1965, he decides that he's going to create his own Formula One car for the first season of the new formula at the time, which is the 3-liter. Mm-hmm. And so he's built a test chassis in 65. And then he gets his first debut, the first McLaren F1. Mm-hmm. And that's the M2B. And, not gonna lie to you, Scott, not perfect. Mm-hmm. It's not a perfect vehicle. It's still testing. One of the problems I got brought up repeatedly when we look into this is, engine problems.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But he did an okay thing. He had a respectable start. You know, he placed. Mm-hmm. But he didn't win, at the Monaco, Grand Prix, and he had the car's designer, a guy named Robin Hurd, who is former aerospace professional.
Makes sense.
Yeah. He started working with Robin Hurd, to use some innovative material science that sort of set a pattern that McLaren would continues to follow today.
Ah, yes, very much so today, because materials are kind of where it's at in racing right now, because everything's about lightweight, about strength, about crumple zones, and the way things absorb energy, and the way they react at speed, and you know, just there's so much that we still need to learn about this stuff. But you can't ever say that you've reach the max in that type of – in that field because you'll see something – well, something like this. I mean this just takes leaps and bounds beyond where it was. And it makes sense to have somebody from the aerospace industry at the time begin to experiment with these lighter weight cars. And then they realized that, you know, it's fine if you have these real high horsepower cars, which is what they did.
Yeah.
They just threw a lot of horsepower at it and it weighed a ton. But, you know, it was still – had the brute force enough to make it, you know – a drivable, I guess, winnable vehicle.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. It doesn't really mean that.
Did you see the material they were using?
No, I didn't.
Okay. So this, Robin Hurd, right? The material that he had been working with, is this thing called malite. And this is basically wood, balsa wood, between two sheets of aluminum in a honeycomb design. And he used that to build the M2B. So it's freaking me out when I read this kind of stuff. You know, a balsa wood car.
Yeah. Well, you remember what we said about 1960s racing, right? How it was just outlandishly dangerous at the time. Remember the whole Jackie Stewart thing with
incredibly unorthodox.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Jackie Stewart, you know, campaigning for safety and, you know, how many people have to die, et cetera. This is. You know, one of those things. It's you're talking about extremely lightweight material that, you know, it's not really meant to hold up in a crash. It's not going to absorb energy like, you know, the carbon fiber does today. It's not designed the way it was today, the way it is today. But, you know, and eventually, you know, that has a tragic outcome in the story. But really, I mean, what Bruce was all about in these early days, you know, once he started building his own vehicles and once they started realizing that, you know, he had, you know, the skills to take what he learned in driving and to use that in, you know, with his engineering background, his design background, that he was able to develop vehicles that were finely tuned. And that was where the McLaren cars really shine because, you know, he took what was already good and made it better by what he could feel in the driver's seat and what he knew as an engineer would work and just the way he thought about things. You know, he really gave it careful consideration. He knew exactly what needed to happen or how he wanted the car to feel and what to do to get to that point. And, that made him valuable as a driver and that made him valuable as a team owner. Mm-hmm. You know, later on that, you know, would be able to say like, here's what I want my car. I want my cars tuned this way. And it became more of a chassis game than it was just brute force with the engine. And then you could lighten the vehicle in other areas based on the way you tune the vehicle. And, you know, we saw that with Jim Hall with right. the downforce idea in mm-hmm. the Chaparral cars. And you saw that, you know, with Lotus and Colin Chapman, he knew that lightweight was the key to speed as well at a certain point. You know, once you've reached the engine's maximum capacity, you know, the maximum size, the maximum output that you could, you know, you're squeezing out a little bit more horsepower here and there. But, you know, the real gains were to be seen in
distribution. You
know, yeah, and lightening the vehicles.
Yeah, in distribution of weight. And I think it's so good to bring up Chaparral, to bring up Lotus, because we see this very obvious pattern that the people who are making some of the breakneck innovations in racing mm-hmm. are those rare individuals who are able to see both sides of the car, if you will, mm-hmm. you know, because it's very easy to assume that an engineer would say, well, here is how we solve a problem, but I'm not sure exactly what the problems are. Mm-hmm. Whereas a driver would say, I need this to do this differently, mm-hmm. but I don't know the language or how to get there.
I don't know how to tell you exactly how to do that. And
right.
he could fine tune it and feel it in a way differently than most others could. Mm-hmm. Some still can, but not many.
It's sort of like in my mind, it's being in that very rare position. It's sort of like being an expert violin player who learns to make violins.
Yes. Yes, that's a good way to say it, because you know, this is it's a rare position, I guess, because rare is the right word to use, because you know, either you have the driving skill or you have the other skill of, you know, being able to run the team and be a competent boss mm-hmm. For everything that's going on, and he was both.
Yeah.
And you know, eventually that led to him. You know, he tested vehicles and he mm-hmm. drove vehicles as well, but he kind of get more on the side of ownership. Mm-hmm. Versus driving. He had other drivers, you know, that were, you know, working for him, working with him. But, you know, let's talk about, now we've talked about mostly Formula One at this point.
Right.
Now let me think about this for 1 second, because there were some Indianapolis wins. And I'm going to have to shuffle my notes for a moment. Sorry.
Oh, in the 70s, are you talking about?
Well, you know what? I want to go earlier than that, because okay. I want to talk about the 1960s, because in the end of 1960s, mm-hmm. He was still in Formula One, and it was also during this period that they kind of moved over to this sort of new series, which is the Canadian American Challenge Cup series, which mm-hmm. was the Can-Am series.
The old Can-Am Cup.
I love the Can-Am Cup.
I know. It's one of your favorite ones.
It is. It really is, because it was just so wild. You know, it was unlimited speed, unlimited horsepower, which led to unlimited speed in some cases. But it was just a cool era, right?
Right.
And they actually jumped into this, and this was what they call the pinnacle of his career, because they were so successful in the Can-Am series.
Mm-hmm.
You know, McLaren Racing, I'm going to read from an article here, but
yeah.
They were in the Group 7 sports cars. And McLaren Racing Limited won support effort from Chevrolet, Goodyear, Reynolds, and Gulf, and produced a McLaren car that won 5 of 6 races in the 1967 series
mm-hmm.
and 4 of 6 in 1968. And then in 1969, Ben, they won all 11 races of that series. So they were dominant. They completely
yeah.
dominated that series through 1969.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just incredible. I mean, they were this is where it comes to kind of a sad ending.
Yeah.
And I hate to, you know, get to this point, but it's inevitable. He died. Bruce McLaren died during testing. He was testing a vehicle called the M8D race car, which was it's the M8D version of the Can-Am car.
Yeah.
That they had. You know, they all had versions. You know, we'll mm-hmm. talk about that too, I guess. Well, maybe not. There's a whole list of them here: the M6A, the M6B, et cetera, all the way down.
Uh-huh.
You know, they got this alphanumeric coding
all the way like M16
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, he was testing on June 2nd, 1970, mm-hmm. and he was at the Goodwood Circuit in England, and some of the rear body work let loose of the vehicle, and of course that means a loss of downforce at the rear of the car. The car, you know, spun out and hit a track official and a flag station, and mm-hmm. You know, that unfortunately was a fatal accident for Mr. Bruce McLaren. So that's the end of Mr. McLaren himself, but not the end of the team.
Far from it.
And not the end of the name, of course, because you'll still hear it in racing circles.
Okay, so we already have a company that has set the course of history in racing. They've made their mark. Unfortunately, for a couple of years after this, late 70s, you know, 78 going into 80,
sure.
The team is not performing as well,
mm-hmm.
which is not necessarily a bad thing. It's understandable because it's just so incredible to have this kind of run.
Oh, sure. That's a long, long run mm-hmm. of success. I mean, that's you can't stay on that pinnacle for too long.
Right, right. And so right as this performance, this a naturally awesome performance is flagging a little bit, a new character enters the story, Mr. Ron Dennis.
Okay.
Now, Ron Dennis worked in Formula One, had a history with it. He used to work with he joined Cooper Cars after McLaren departed
mm-hmm.
and started his own F2 team in 71. So this guy has some extensive experience.
Sure, and close ties to Bruce, really.
Right, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, and they move in the same circles. Mm-hmm. And so in 1980, McLaren merges with Project 4 Racing Team, which is Ron Dennis's outfit.
Mm-hmm.
So he brings back some not new blood, I guess, but he brings back a designer named John Barnard.
Mm-hmm.
And John Barnard was a designer on the Chaparral 2K.
Mm-hmm.
And he, you know, that's the one that won Indianapolis. He had also been working with McLaren earlier in the 70s. And during that time, he worked on their M23 car.
M23, yeah, I know. Well, these alphanumeric cars are tough to figure out sometimes how they read them exactly.
I was kind of making a bad joke, but
okay.
But so here we go again. We talked about material science.
Yeah.
Okay. So Barnard also is emphasizing material science, and he starts working with carbon fiber composite. Now, mm-hmm. people who have listened to our show before know that we're big fans of carbon fiber,
of course.
And this kind of design work in the 80s is prescient,
mm-hmm.
and there's not really a way around it. Carbon fiber, if it was a bit cheaper, would probably be in the car of every person listening to this show now.
Oh, sure. Yeah, it probably would be. I mean, that's the whole game right now. So trying to – and you know, I think they're even moving beyond carbon fiber to even stronger materials at this point. But
sure.
Trying to find a cheap way to mass produce carbon fiber and to form it, you know, so that it's not such an arduous task in the assembly process, because it just makes the vehicles too expensive. But yeah, if they could get that into modern vehicles, it would be there right now. In fact, it is in some areas. You see it on performance vehicles in accents and small areas. Maybe not the entire car, of course,
mm-hmm.
but you know, those are the supercar, the $1 million supercars. But
right.
Yeah, if there was a way to get it into production vehicles, you know that manufacturers would do it if it was cost effective.
So. They managed to build one. McLaren does, with some help by Hercules Aerospace. So again, we see at the forefront of material science, right? The aerospace guys.
Hercules. Sorry.
Did you really?
Yeah, I did. I don't know. It just came out. Sorry. Sorry, everybody. Sorry.
No, I
guess I have to say it like three. Hercules, Hercules, Hercules. Okay.
You got
We're done.
Me.
We're done with that.
Okay. You got me on that one.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's go to the MP4. Series.
Okay.
So they've got one victory in 1981 mm-hmm. on this vehicle. 1982, they have four victories.
Not bad.
1983, they have another victory.
Wait, going back a year?
Wait, 1980. No, they have four in 1982.
Okay.
And then in 1983, they had one more.
Okay, got it.
Okay. It sounds like a math problem,
yeah,
right?
A little
like
bit.
A word problem. So he left heading 48 miles an hour. No, I'm kidding. I'm kidding. I doubt they drove 48 miles an hour ever.
Yeah, no, probably not.
All right. So on the way, after we see these winds in the 80s, we see more winds continuing through the 90s. You know, we see the Drivers' Championships. Mm-hmm. We see the Constructors' Championships. We see a very interesting relationship with Honda.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. You know, when you talk about McLaren, you talk about racing, you talk mm-hmm. about all these people that are involved with Bruce McLaren and these partnerships. We said Goodyear was with them.
Yeah.
And, all these sponsorships and the big names in racing, I'm talking about people now, drivers that were associated with McLaren Racing. Of course, there's Bruce McLaren, there's Johnny Rutherford, who's a big name,
mm-hmm.
Mark Donahue, another mm-hmm. huge name,
yeah.
Emerson Fittipaldi, which is these are all big names. Alain Prost,
it's a who's who of racing.
Ayrton Senna, which is, always a favorite. Mm-hmm. And, mm-hmm. Mika Hakkinen later on and, Lewis Hamilton drives, McLaren Mercedes. And, mm-hmm. It's just the names and the circles that, these drivers kind of work in and the mm-hmm. way they combine and the way that, drivers move from team to team. And Dan Gurney was one of the drivers for a while. It's impressive to read the history of McLaren cars.
Mm-hmm.
There's just so many big names, so many things happening for them, so many successes that it's a good story. It's a good read if you want to find out about Bruce McLaren. Look up some of this autobiography information and get the full detail on it because we're kind of glossing over the years. What happened where he won scholarships for driving and that's
yes.
how he eventually made it in the sport.
Mm-hmm.
There's just stuff that you have to kind of skip over if we want to give you the Cliff Notes version of this.
There's so many fascinating bits of trivia, though, Scott.
Oh.
Okay, because we skipped over Ayrton Senna without mentioning that he's the fastest driver in the world, or was.
Was, yeah. Was
the fastest
time.
Driver
That's
in the
right,
world.
Up until, 94 or something like that. You're right. I mean, this could be, an entire Trivial Pursuit category.
We can't go down the rabbit hole.
Honestly, let me mention one thing, though.
Yes.
I have to, because yeah. This is one of my all-time favorite kit cars, I think, the McLaren cars, the ones that look like the kit cars that resemble the McLaren Rogue cars, because there were a couple of Rogue cars. There was the M6 GT, and I believe there was the M12 GT as well
mm-hmm.
For Rogue cars, but that's about it for Rogue cars. The rest were race cars of some sort. But if you remember in a TV series called Hardcastle McCormick. Yeah. The Coyote. I'm going to show you a picture right now, and you'll remember it. The one on top.
I do.
There. You
yes.
remember that car?
Yes.
The criminal that lived with the judge. You remember that?
That's so ridiculous. I barely remember the show, but
yeah.
I remember the car.
The Coyote. Yeah, that was a really cool car at the time. Of course, it was a kit car,
mm-hmm.
and it was called it was a Marauder kit car. Now, I also like the. I think I prefer the Manta Mirage car, which mm-hmm. is the one on the bottom there, Ben, if you want to take a quick look at that. But
wow.
That is a slick looking Rogue car.
Oh, that'd be a good look for you.
And that is that's basically what the McLaren Rogue cars look like.
Beautiful.
So that was the cars that he was designing for road use, not racing, but road use. And they do have a bit of a Can-Am look to them, which is,
mm-hmm.
Also, I don't know, that's probably why it's one of my favorites. They kind of ties together, right? And we can't let this leave this alone without saying that modern McLaren cars are still around. You can still buy a McLaren. In fact, the newest McLaren model is the MP4 12C,
the supercar.
Yeah, that's right. And the price on this thing is about $900,000, Ben, with no options. That's just the base model.
Right. Yeah.
And I kind of dug into this a little bit, and it says that up to date. It's still not available right now, but 40 orders have been taken. You have to leave a $50,000 non-refundable deposit.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people are saying, well, I'd like to know exactly what I get for my, $900,000, because that's not entirely known yet.
Oh, I've got some rough stats.
Oh, do you?
Just a couple.
Okay, because there's 60 other people ready to take that $50,000 leap.
Once they know.
But they don't know the list of options and features yet. They don't know the full price because that may go well beyond that $900,000
mark. Yeah, that's a good point.
What have you got? I mean, this is their second car in what, 17 years is what it said?
Pretty much.
So,
yeah.
You know, this is a road car. It's a big deal. Remember the McLaren F1 was a $1 million car, and you'll see, you know, the likes of Jay Leno driving this.
Right.
He's got one in his garage. It's the one where you sit in the center of the vehicle and you have two passengers on either side, which I think is insane.
Oh, I remember. I have a picture of that.
What have you got about the new one?
Okay. So here we go. The MP4 12 seat has a 3.8 liter V8.
3.8 liter? What?
That's the local, that's like the stat, man.
Oh, okay.
That's what we're getting from the horse's mouth.
Got to be a small, powerful engine.
Yeah. It's a McLaren, their own in-house design, 600 horsepower, 442 pound-feet of torque.
Whoa.
369 of that comes from 2,000 RPM to 6,800 RPM.
That's pretty high revving.
Yeah.
Now, that's, 3.8 liter, 600 what?
3.8 liter, 600 horsepower.
Wow.
And so they've got a – check this out. I thought you would like this. A 0 to 125 mile per hour time under 10 seconds.
Whoa. Very nice.
So you know this thing has to be like a box of feathers. It can't weigh very much.
That's unbelievable. That's incredible.
Top speed just all they know is in excess of 200.
Because this is – you know, when I'm saying that's incredible, I know other cars will go 0 to 100 to 0 faster.
Sure.
But you know what? This is a pretty big car.
Yes.
I've seen photos of this. I mean, now it's low, it's wide, and it's long. It's a big car.
Yeah, it's low slung, but 125 miles an hour to 0 miles an hour, under 5 seconds.
Oh, my gosh. That would have to feel like your face is pulling off.
You have to have one of those, one of the racing belts.
Oh, sure, the five-point harness
or
something, the submarine belt.
So, they at this point, and this is some of the newer announcements here, they claim to have received more than 1,600 intentions to purchase.
Oh, that's far more than
this is building up, and we have to be careful about the way intention to purchase is, you know, because we have to also remember, not to say anything bad, but we do have to remember this is the company saying it.
Okay.
And we've done a lot of shows with companies making announcements.
Sure.
And,
but you know what? A new McLaren would draw some interest. It would, you know, ignite some fires, I think, in people that, you know, are collectors and people that, you know, remember the original, McLaren, the F1.
Yeah.
And say, yeah, I think I want to get in on that ground level.
And here's the thing I wanted to end on. And no, this is all I've got. This is the last thing.
Okay, me too.
McLaren is, apparently developing two more road cars.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
So, well, I don't know anything about them yet.
Great.
But we'll have to check in. So I guess this is us wrapping it up then.
Any chance, Ben, that those are in like the $15,000 to $20,000 range?
Oh, gosh. I'm hoping the guys from Tata Nano Car.
I'm sure it's going to be, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, they make one that's $900,000 plus, and then the other one is $20,000.
Yeah, it's a kit car, though.
Yeah, sure.
It comes with just the hubcaps.
Yeah, right. Okay, yeah, that would be about all you'd get, I think.
Well, guys, I know we jumped around a lot here, but we're trying to give you some highlights of a really long, fascinating story in the history of racing and automotives in general. We hope you enjoyed it as much as we've enjoyed it.
Yeah, I mean, this guy, he's only 32 years old, and to accomplish all of that by the time you're 32 – he was 32 in 1970 when he passed away. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, just a remarkable career and what a legacy.
Yes.
You know, what a legacy.
A true prodigy.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, if you have been listening to us do this podcast, you were wondering why we haven't covered, your favorite pioneer of the automotive, era or age or industry, then now's the time to speak up. Hit us up at Facebook. Find us on Twitter. You can also check out our website for more information. We have some pretty neat automotive articles there. And if you want to tell us who we should cover in an upcoming episode, please send us an email at
carstuff@howstuffworks.com.
Be sure to check out our new video podcast, Stuff from the Future. Join How Stuff Works staff as we explore the most promising and perplexing possibilities of tomorrow. The How Stuff Works iPhone app has arrived. Download it today on iTunes.
Let's clear out winter and clean up the lawn with Spring Black Friday savings at the Home Depot. Right now, get the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower for just $89 and make your lawn work easier with a powerful 90 miles an hour of clearing power. And with convenient online shopping, you can order on the app, pick up in store, and get outside sooner. Get your yard spring ready with the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower, now just $89 during Spring Black Friday at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
You've probably heard a lot about electrified vehicles lately. Well, Toyota has electrified options for every lifestyle. We've got hybrids, no plug needed.
All right, let's go.
But we also have plug-in hybrids, if that's your thing. You can even go 100% electric in the Toyota bZ4X. With so many options for reducing carbon emissions, Toyota is electrified, diversified. Learn more about our Beyond Zero vision for the future at toyota.com/beyondzero.
Viking. Committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, cultural enrichment, and all-inclusive fares. Discover more at viking.com.